sometimes, in our attempts to improve things, we just make matters worse. It's this idea that I want to talk about this morning. Before beginning, let me say by way of introduction that Unitarian Universalist ministers are encouraged to be familiar with several languages of faith, is how I think of it. We're supposed to be able to talk about religious and ethical and philosophical issues from different perspectives and using different terminology, scientifically and humanistically for sure, but also through lenses provided by various of the world religions and other perspectives as well, naturalistic theism, the human potential movement, and of course Christianity and Judaism. I'm going to focus on a Jewish idea today, but I'll be using mostly the language of traditional 19th century, early 20th century universalism. Now, the old universalists were every bit as reason-centered as their Unitarian cousins, but they tended to be more biblical, and they tended to focus more on just trying to be good to one another instead of thinking right. Acting right was more of a thing to them. So, farpachket, definition, something that's all fouled up, especially as a result of an attempt to fix it. An important linguistic category is the collection of terms we have in every language used to describe all the ways things can go very wrong. Two terms that come from the military describe machinery or systems that have gone seriously awry: FUBAR and SNAFU. Apocryphal lexicography has it that FUBAR is an acronym for all fouled up or fouled up beyond all recovery. And SNAFU is an acronym for situation normal, all fouled up. It is probable, of course, that military men used a stronger word than fouled. But these are general terms. Technology requires precise terminology. The Yiddish word, farpachket, has a degree of specificity required for modern complex technology. It refers to something that's all fouled up, especially through repeated failed attempts to fix it. It's like this picture of me and my friends in seminary trying to fix our cars. When something minor goes wrong with the car, for example, your attempt to repair it turns minor damage into something major, you can say that your car is farpachket. In a political sense, the fall of Richard Nixon started out as a third-rate burglary that got all farpachket when the White House attempted to cover it up. The word has a satisfying onomatopoeic poetic ring to it. It sounds like what you're describing. That software was slightly buggy before your programmers tried to fix it, but now it's royally farpachket. Sometimes the more energy you put into trying to fix something, the worse it gets. Consider Uncle Remus's story about Br'er Rabbit and the tar baby. In our country, the phrase tar baby, to refer to a problem that gets worse the more one struggles against it, is a well-known metaphor. But it's bigger than only the United States folklore. So ubiquitous is this pattern, things getting worse the more one struggles against them, that Joseph Campbell, in one of his comparative mythology books, noted over 140 cultural variations of the tar baby story. We are all familiar with this dynamic. Farpachket is typically a technological metaphor. However, I want to look at it this morning in a psychological and ecological terms, more perhaps more like a tar baby. Now, the 4th century BC Greek philosopher Plato has been called the father of Western philosophy. Alfred North Whitehead summed it up memorably when he wrote that 2,500 years of Western philosophy consists of a series of footnotes to Plato. Plato believed that we are born perfect, that we come out of mystery perfectly aware, but that we lose our internal connection to our source, to that mystery, and as we do, as we grow, we lose that connection to what in the Hebraic tradition, Prophet Elijah referred to as the still small voice. You know, I think it's 1 Kings where Elijah goes to the mountaintop and he hears the thunder. He's got a direct line to Yahweh and he says, "No, that's not me. I'm not there." And the majestic mountaintops and the sun, "No, that's not me." The beasts of the sea, "No." And then he hears the still, small, inner voice, like the voice of conscience. And that's where Yahweh resides. But we lose that connection. It's the Hebrew story, but according to Plato, we lose that as we become schooled culturally, and slowly we lose our innocence. It's part of it, too. And then you become well-schooled, but you forget this inner connection, this touchstone that centers you. Despite that is coming out of perfection, or in Plato's world, the realm of the forms, and into life, we are corrupted automatically by the culture, every culture in which we happen to live. But there is a way back. And for Plato, that way was philosophy, which he understood as essentially a religious endeavor. Platonic philosophy differs from Christianity by virtue of its emphasis on knowledge. For Plato, pride is pride of intellect, thinking you have all the answers, thinking you know when you don't. Sin is ignorance, being not aware, and salvation is recollection, recognizing, remembering your true identity and your connection to the source. Now, Plato's not the only person who held that returning or coming back to our natural, unschooled mind is the first step in religious growth or the maturation of soul. Consider Zen master Shunryu Suzuki. His magnum opus, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, getting back to that youthful mind, where the physician Andrew Weil, who wrote his first bestseller, was The Natural Mind. Child development author Joseph Chilton Pierce, The Magical Child. The neo-pagan author and self-described witch Starhawk, who writes in The Spiral Dance of the intuitive knowledge that our link through intuition to the inner goddess. Or the Roman Catholic philosopher and social critic Ivan Illich, De-schooling society, helping us stop making an icon of the cultural words we learned and learn to be in touch with the dynamic inner truth of your soul, really, your heart of hearts. Now, all these religious leaders and scholars agree on one basic principle. As human beings, we are born naturally perfect, but we keep messing things up. And sometimes the more we try, like Bear Rabbit, the more fouled up we and everything around us becomes. And yet, for some reason, we keep trying. We feel alienated, at a loss, or somehow imperfect. And thinking somehow we can defy gravity, we struggle to pull ourselves up by our spiritual bootstraps. Now, this is a long-time Unitarian goal, self-improvement. It runs very deep in our UU movement, and it runs deep throughout Western and American history, even today. Consider the New Age religious movements, Est and Scientology, both organized to generate millions by luring would-be self-improvement adepts with promises to get it and become clear. The earliest American Unitarians were almost exclusively fourth and fifth generation Puritans, more cosmopolitan than their ancestors, though they definitely were. Their theology retained an emphasis on willful self-improvement, as evidenced by William Ellery Channing's call to grow in self-culture. Now, I've spoken about this before. Choosing one's better nature, choosing to listen to your, Lincoln called your better angels, choosing to grow spiritually, to become more sensitive and aware. And while it's a good impulse, it's an impulse that can get out of bounds. Well, like any self-improvement impulses like that, consider, you know, the urge to stay trim can lead to anorexia, which is when that urge gets out of balance. Our tradition actually offers balance, for while the early American Unitarians all descended from Puritans, early Universalists did not. They descended mostly from later immigrants, many of them former Baptists and Methodists. Moreover, like Plato and unlike Br'er Rabbit, the Universalists accepted human nature as they found it. Quoting St. Paul, our early Universalist forebears were clear: as all fell in Adam, all are saved in Christ. The gig is up. The sacrifice has been made. You don't have to do anything about it. You're saved exactly the way you are and before you were born. And relax, I mean, relax. Stop worrying so much about it. Quit trying so hard. There's a tendency to try to earn our way to salvation by being good, rather than simply accepting ourselves as whole and loved by the Creator the way we are. One doesn't have to be a theist to get what I'm trying to say. Just dispense with the theistic language, if you prefer, and put the whole matter in intrapsychic psychological terms, liberating oneself from an unmerciful superego, accepting yourself as okay in spite of negative programming you may have received as a child to the contrary. The downfall in recent years of two mega churchmen, Colorado Springs' Ted Haggard and Atlanta's Bishop Eddie Long, are contemporary examples of a person stuck to a tar baby trying to fix what ain't broken. Like the Puritans, Ted Haggard and Eddie Long were sensitive enough to see the reality of good and evil, of better angels and less good angels. But they were unable to accept their human lot as both. Instead, they tried to make themselves only good, which meant they had to suppress the supposedly bad longings they both had for physical intimacy with men. The trouble is, suppression is like a tar baby. Repeatedly push your true nature away and you get stuck. Keep at it, and before long you will be covered with tar. Whatever we suppress again and again eventually becomes repressed, that is, walled off, unconscious, and dangerous, especially to oneself. One tries harder and harder to push it down and to push it away by projecting it onto others, by repressing one's true nature. But repressing one's true nature can only work for so long. Indeed, the repression-projection cycle almost inevitably ends up another of the many harder they come, harder they fall situations. Just ask the Reverend Haggard or Bishop Eddie Long. There is nothing dirty in nature, wrote the Italian movie director Lena Wertmüller. It's the repression-projection dynamic that creates the whole concept of pornography in the first place by causing us to dump our natural instincts and hide them, repressing them until we create tawdry red light districts, prostitutes, tasteless porno, and the whole sordid mess. There is nothing dirty in nature. I remember attending an off-Broadway production of Lansford Wilson's play, Burn This. This was in New York City back in the late 80s at the height of the AIDS pandemic. It's a drama about four friends of a young gay dancer struggling to cope with his untimely death. At the turning point of the whole play, the critical line is uttered. Tell the truth. There is nothing you can imagine that has not been felt by everyone. I believe that. It's our repression that makes it dirty. Another memory, this one from 25 years ago, when conservative Republicans, including the late United States Senator Jesse Helms, made a traveling exhibition of Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs, a focus of their indignant tirades in the so-called culture war over federal funding of the National Endowment for the Arts. At the height of the controversy, the show at the Cincinnati Contemporary Arts Center was closed by local right-wing activists, its fate put into the hands of 8 unsophisticated Ohio jurors. Hyper-Puritan Jesse Helms, like many of his contemporary counterparts around us right now, considered Mapplethorpe's work to be dirty, and he railed against it. The jurors did not, one of whom was quoted in the newspaper saying, "I didn't think the photos were Michelangelo, but they were impressive. They weren't really offensive either. Besides, once you start dictating what's allowed in the art museum, the next thing you know, they'll be in the library, then inside our houses." In other words, give Senator Helm and his ilk their way, and the next thing you know, it'll be totally Farpochkin. This same tar baby dynamic applies equally well, it seems to me, in our ecological crises. On a certain level, it seems as though the more we try to remedy things, the worse it all gets. Modern inoculation procedures cure diseases but can deplete the gene pool and lead to overpopulation. Automobiles make getting around easier but have led to excess CO2. Local officials build a breakwater that redirects the surf down the coast, ruining earlier development. The list goes on and on. My main point this morning, in nature as in life, the problem is often one of doing too much. To find our way anew, we often have to quit trying so hard, as in the Chinese notion of wu wei, literally, to not push. Perhaps the closest idea in Western religious language is that of accepting grace. Typically, our efforts towards self-improvement only help so far, ending in disillusionment with the insight that no perfect virtue, no complete obedience, no fully adequate service exists. Perfect righteousness and consistent goodness is unattainable. This leads to despair. Despair that either leads to defeat or to a third realm of the spirit, an advance into grace and a kind of release to a new, higher kind of irresponsibility, or to put it simply, to faith. To the understanding that we should certainly strive to be good and to make the world better. But we are not responsible for the imperfections of the world or for our own. Do your best. Keep your eyes on the prize, and then let it go. But here's the thing. Almost invariably, we've got to go through despair to an acceptance of this deep primordial love, the love that is the creativity at the heart of creation and the heart of each person, which can then lead to compassion for others and for ourselves. Many people have written and spoken about the all-too-human, oft-repeated pattern I'm talking about, a pattern that many of us, I'm sure, are familiar with. Trying to fix everything, or maybe trying to run everything until it's all farpachka, leading to despair, leading to a breakthrough of insight, and with it a new, healthier perspective. Consider the descriptions by various recording artists of their process of artistic self-discovery. For example, "I Forgot That Love Existed" by Van Morrison, or "Help" by, that's about my favorite Lennon song. How about the slogan so comforting to many people in 12-step recovery programs? Mantras such as, "You are not the general manager of the universe." "Let go and let God." And "Easy does it." From slogans to song lyrics to literature, each a variation on Platonic self-inquiry. That is, each a different example of the recollection, recognizing, and cleansing of one's soul. None of my remarks this morning are to suggest that trying to grow spiritually or trying to improve conditions around us or that rational decision-making and problem-solving have no place, but only to know when to stop and to give it and oneself a rest before things get all farpachka, especially in the realm of our inner personal work. For this is the great principle of universalism. We are okay the way we are. We are saved, if you will, just the way we are, with all our foibles and troubles and frustrations. Universalists celebrate that fact, as must we. I was touched during 2018 to read the tributes posted in connection with the death of my stepbrother, Arnold C. Saunders IV. Arnie, as we all called him, had been exposed to rubella in utero. Despite lifelong disabilities, his family, and mostly his two sons and my stepsister and brother-in-law, always kept him close and well-loved. The online homages, one after another, affirmed his sweet nature, his dependability, and his ever-present kindness. Now, Arnie was no superstar. For 35 years, he worked as the night manager at the Waterville, Maine Holiday Inn. But he was surely a hero. A poem posted on Arnie's obituary website echoes the point I've been making about the essence of universalism, that human nature is good the way it is, and to trust it and allow it to be, to accept ourselves, our moods, our concerns, and the struggles we go through, all of which are part of life and all of which are okay. The poem is by the Afghani poet Rumi, 13th century, "The Guest House." This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if there's a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Grace, the love of God, the love of the creative forces that from whence brought us to be, and love of others reaching out to us, these are available at every hand, at every moment, if we just loosen up and accept it. Many of our attempts to make ourselves, not to mention the world, better only make it more farpachka. If on your way through life you can learn to pass certain tar babies by, more power to you. Like Rumi, you've allowed yourself, your soul, to become a guest house. If you can't always do that and find yourself from time to time sticky with tar, be careful you don't make matters worse until it's totally farpachka. And you have to go back into that old briar patch for another round of despair, followed by new insight, followed by striving, followed by despair, followed by insight again. The cycle of life and love and growth. So may it be. Shalom, namaste, salam, and amen.